This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the forensic autopsy, and I'm going to warn you that some of the photographs there are a bit graphic. So if you're uncomfortable, please avert your eyes, but I'm not going to change it because that's part of the educational process. And then I'm going to talk about traumatic injuries, specifically blunt trauma, sharp trauma, and gunshot wounds, so you can see and get a sense of an overview of what a forensic pathologist does and how we interpret injury. And then I'll speak briefly about my role as an expert witness and a consultant for the legal system. So first of all, I'm going to explain that a lot of doctors don't know the distinction between a coroner and a medical examiner. Here in California, we primarily have coroners, but here in the county of San Francisco, we have a medical examiner system. And the difference is that coroners are citizens. In many states, they have no specified training. They just can be elected coroner, be over 18 years of age. And in California, they need a two-week course that is nicknamed Coroner's College. I believe it's down in Ventura County. And after that two-week course, they can be certified as a coroner and write death certificates in traumatic injury cases. Oftentimes, they're administrators or law enforcement officers, and they can be either elected or appointed. In contrast, medical examiners are by definition physicians. They're usually forensic board certified, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. And they tend to have a public health function, either be part of the public health department or interact with them on a more regular basis. And because of all the training needed to be a medical examiner, the medical training, these positions tend to be appointed. So if you look at death investigation systems in the United States by the different type, it's a hodgepodge of systems. Some counties have medical examiners, some have coroners. There's also state medical examiner systems throughout the country. And really, the death investigation is done on a county-by-county level. And if any of you have an opportunity to see the Frontline documentary, it's called Postmortem. It's actually streaming online. So if you have an interest in forensics, I recommend Googling or searching for Frontline Postmortem and seeing it. It explains the discrepancies between the quality of death investigation systems, sometimes in adjacent counties. So in California, for instance, we have 58 counties, 47 are sheriff coroner, where the sheriff runs the death investigation division, 7 are coroner, that means that it's run by an administrator, not part of law enforcement, and 1 is a bifurcated system, it's called ME Coroner, Los Angeles, though I think as of a few months ago, it became a medical examiner system. The 3 pure ME systems are San Diego, San Francisco, and Ventura County, where the chief medical examiner is a board-certified forensic pathologist. And what's important about this is that you'll see discrepancies between the quality that's done in different jurisdictions based on how much money they invest into the system, whether they have board-certified pathologists working for them, and also with regards to the sometimes year-to-year you can have changes as people come and go. So what does it take to be me? What does it take to be a board-certified forensic pathologist? That means that you're certified by an organization called the American Board of Pathology. And this is also important because I'll show you in a minute, there are sham certifications out there, and that's also covered by the Frontline documentary, that sham certifications do exist. You can get yourself an online expertise that doesn't make you qualified. So to be me, you need 4 years of medical school. You need 3 to 4 years of residency. When I was going through it, I had to actually be 5. And then 1 year of fellowship. And then you have to sit or pass an anatomic pathology exam before you're eligible to take a second exam in forensic pathology. Because this takes a lot of time and because it costs a lot of money, there are not that many forensic pathologists who are board certified in the United States. There's only, by estimates, between 350 to 450 board certified forensic pathologists currently practicing in the U.S., which is about half of what we need to do all the forensic autopsies. So because it requires so much training, and people have this misunderstanding that somehow pathologists, I think based on television and the media, spring out of the womb all-knowing, I wrote this book, Working Stiff, about my training at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, and my co-author and husband is actually sitting back there, so if you want to ask him about the writing process, he's more the writer, I'm the doctor. So this is the sham qualification. In contrast to the true qualifications, you can go online and go to the American College of Forensic Examiners, and they have a website, and they offer certification in forensic accounting, forensic nursing, homeland security, forensic consulting, and medical investigations. And for $145 a year, you get a membership dues, and they give all you have to do is supply them with a copy of your highest diploma, your resume, any licenses, and 3 references. And then you have to attend a 2-day conference. That way they get another $445 from you. Or you can have a test proctored at your local library. And this certification process is not the same, but there are people who use this in lieu of getting true board certification, and they claim that they're certified to testify in cases. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about what the law says about deaths and what deaths come to a medical examiner or coroner. And this is defined by California Health and Safety Code 10250 and Government Code 27491. And the overview is any death that's violent, sudden, or unusual, any death that's not attended by a physician in the last 20 days, any death related to an accident or injury, either old or recent. And see how vague that is, either old or recent? So it's intentionally vague because we want to capture, we want people to call us about all these deaths. And then that phone call that we get at the medical examiner or coroner's office is our screening tool to see which cases come in under our jurisdiction. Any deaths that are homicide, suicide, or accident, or any death due to a criminal act. And the reporting requirements is that the ME or coroner has to be notified for those types of death, but the only requirement is for them to investigate. There's no requirement for us to do an autopsy. All we have to do is investigate. And that investigation can just be that first phone call when we ask questions from the person who's reporting the death, and we decide, or the investigator decides, based on that phone call, whether or not the case should fall under our jurisdiction. MEs and coroners also have a right to the medical record. They do not need consent from next of kin to get it. And we can have it subpoenaed, but we shouldn't have to. We're actually HIPAA exempt. And the reason for this is that sometimes there is no next of kin. And also sometimes the next of kin are somehow responsible for the death. And our job as medical examiners and coroners are to investigate deaths, even when the next of kin or the people who have control over those records might be responsible. That's why permission from the next of kin is not required for an ME or coroner autopsy. So if a hospital autopsy is being done, if somebody dies in a hospital and they want to do an autopsy at the hospital, as long as the death is natural, as long as it's not due to some sort of trauma or falls under those suspicious circumstances, it can be done in the hospital. And the doctors at the hospital don't have to know exactly what the cause of death is. In some cases, that's why they're getting an autopsy. But they have to at least know that it's probably natural, so it won't fall under the jurisdiction of the ME or coroner. So now I'm going to go a little bit in more detail so you understand that deaths that are suspected or known homicides, suspected or known suicide, and see this, even suspected needs to be reported. And the law says that an accident, whether it's the primary cause or only contributory, whether the accident occurred immediately or at some remote time. And notice that big basket. So even if you had an accident that occurred 20 years ago that somehow resulted in your death, that case needs to be reported to the ME or coroner. Any grounds to suspect that the death occurred in any degree from a criminal act. So, for instance, if someone comes into the emergency room and is having chest pain and says, I was assaulted on the street, and then 5 minutes later I started having the chest pain, then that needs to be reported, even if he ends up dying of a heart attack because of his blocked blood vessels. Because of the association with the assault, that case needs to be reported. Any ground and any case where there's no physician in attendance, that basically means the person has no medical history or hasn't been seen by a physician in the last 20 days prior to death. Now, we do get a lot of calls to the ME or coroner's office where a person is dying, they have cancer, they're on hospice care, but they haven't seen their doctor in 25 days or 30 days. They still need to be called in under the law, and then typically these cases are released from jurisdiction. We'll say, thank you very much for calling. You followed the law. We are not taking that case in. And that's it. And then we've done our job at the ME's office, and the person who reported it did their job. And then finally, cases where the physician is unable to state the cause of death, and they have to be genuinely unable and not merely unwilling. We do have circumstances where doctors call our office and say, well, he had hepatitis and he had kidney failure and he also had COPD and heart disease, but I really don't know what killed him. And so then, you know, maybe his wife poisoned him. And it's not just rampant speculation. You have to have a good reason to suspect his wife poisoned him to report it to our office. In most cases, you can pick one of those. We're not going to answer between those four, okay, as long as they're natural. But poisonings do need to be reported to our office, and those involve food, chemical, drug, and even therapeutic agents. Any deaths due to occupational disease or injury, because typically other agencies such as OSHA investigate, and the public has a right to know, and there is a public interest in knowing whether corporations or businesses or occupational scenarios can be a risk for other people. All deaths in operating rooms or following surgery or a major medical procedure. And that's important because if somebody dies in the hospital, in an operating room, or in the recovery room where they haven't recovered from anesthesia, which is the last point, those autopsies cannot be done in the hospital. Number one, because there's a potential for conflict of interest. And number two, because the hospital autopsies routinely do not do toxicology. Okay? So unless there is a compelling reason why that case should be left out of the medical examiner's office, my druthers is to have it brought in and have it investigated by a forensic specialist as opposed to have it done at the hospital. But then again, like I said, the decision of whether a case comes in or not depends a lot on the individual jurisdiction and the person taking that phone call, whether they're a medical examiner investigator who has training and experience or not, and the person who's giving them information about the underlying reason for the death. All solitary deaths need to be reported, and that means that there's no physician, family member, or other responsible person. And all deaths where the patient is comatose. And the reason for that is because the person can't tell you what happened to them. And you're relying exclusively on a medical chart that may have what we call chart lore, where somebody writes something down and just it gets repeated over and over again in the chart, but it actually hasn't been proven or corroborated or tested for. So that's why those deaths need to be reported. All deaths of unidentified persons, because we have to identify them in order to write their death certificate. And all deaths where the suspected cause of death is sudden infant death syndrome. And that's because SIDS is a diagnosis of exclusion. You can't write that on the death certificate unless you've done an autopsy. All deaths in prisons, jails, or persons under the control of a law enforcement agency. And this is also a very important role for the medical examiner, is to be an independent arbiter of the care that people are getting in our state facilities and under the control of the police. We want to know, we have a public interest in knowing that these people are getting medical care and that they're not being beaten up or murdered. And all deaths of patients in state mental hospitals for the same reason. We want to make sure that they're being treated properly and that they're being medicated appropriately. All deaths where there's no known next of kin, because somebody has to take control of the body and decide what the disposition of the remains are, going to bury them or cremate them. And then there usually is a public administrator who's involved in that process of dispersing their assets and making sure the body is put in a certain way and actually looking for the next of kin. All deaths caused by a known or suspected contagious disease constituting a public health hazard to include AIDS. And the reason for that is we're the front line for public health agencies in recognizing emerging infectious diseases. So if somebody is dying suddenly of an unknown and unidentified disease, we have to take control of that body to make sure, number one, that it's quarantine to some degree, and number two, that we can identify what the agent is, have it tested, make sure we have the right specimens for public health agencies to identify what the source of the infection is. And then all deaths due to acute alcohol or drug intoxication. So I'm going to go through a typical California death certificate, and a lot of doctors don't fill these out properly. okay? And I want you to understand that we have to write these because they have public health implications and because they're used for research. They have a lot of utility besides just being a document that you can use to close bank accounts. So there's a box on the death certificate that says that whether the death was reported to the ME or coroner, and it's just a yes or no box. And then the cause of death is actually split up into four sections: A, due to B, due to C, due to D. I'm going to explain to you how we create that sequence. And then there's another box called other significant conditions contributing to death, but not causing 107A above. So this could be all the other diseases. So a typical death certificate would be something like myocardial infarction, which is heart attack, due to atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, due to hardening of the arteries from cholesterol. And then if the person also has diabetes, the diabetes could be under 112 for other significant conditions contributing to death. That would be kind of a standard death certificate. And then there's also a box for medical and surgical procedures and their dates. So the definition of cause of death is something that I was actually forced to memorize in my fellowship. And the chief medical examiner, Dr. Hirsch, would catch you in the hallway and say, "What's the cause of death?" And you would have to say the following. It's the etiologically specific disease or injury which starts the lethal sequence of events without sufficient intervening causes. I'm going to go back through this line by line so you understand what it means. Etiologically specific means not due to anything else. So let's take heart attack, for instance. Heart attack is something that people die from, right? People can die of a heart attack? Wrong. They don't die of myocardial infarctions, because you can have a myocardial infarction due to hardening of your arteries from cholesterol, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. You can also have a heart attack, a myocardial infarction, from cocaine. So you took a little bit too much cocaine today, and that causes a vasospasm, a narrowing of one of your blood vessels, and you have a heart attack. And you can also have a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, after suffering a gunshot wound to your leg, which caused you to bleed out, and you survived the initial insult, but you got hospitalized, and while you were hospitalized, you had your heart attack, because of the combination of the blood loss and a little bit of narrowing of your vessels. So the first one is natural. It's atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. The second one is an accident from cocaine. And the third one's a homicide from being shot. And that's the difference between a cause of death and a mechanism of death. And I'll show you mechanisms in a minute. The MI, the heart attack, is a mechanism. But the thing that caused it, the etiologically specific, what is that heart attack due to? That's the cause. And it's either going to be a disease, like the hardening of the arteries, or an injury, like the gunshot wound, which started the lethal sequence of events. And that's why all of those laws that say in remote time are included in this. Because if you have a person who's at the age of 20, decides to jump off a diving board and breaks their neck and becomes a quadriplegic, and someone saves him from the water, so he survives, but he's now a quadriplegic. And he then dies at the ripe old age of 40 for a quadriplegic, with complications of quadriplegia, with bed sores and with recurrent pneumonias and recurrent urinary tract infections because he can't move his arms and he can't breathe effectively, okay? I don't care that there was a 20-year interval between when he had the injury and when he died. It started the lethal sequence of events that led to his death. The key caveat is without sufficient intervening causes. So if that quadriplegic then gets going to the bank, and while he's in the bank taking out his money, a robber comes in and shoots him, that's a sufficient intervening cause. The cause of death is no longer complications of blunt trauma of neck with quadriplegia. It is now gunshot wound of chest, and it's a different manner, too. It's a homicide instead of an accident. So the manner of death is what is determined in most part by the medical examiner, because hospital autopsies can only be natural. Hospital deaths can only be natural. But if the death gets referred to the medical examiner or the coroner, it can fall under multiple categories. Natural is due to disease or aging. Accident is due to an unforeseeable act or a hostile environment. Like, you know, the typical ones we see are motor vehicle collisions. That's the most typical act. It falls from ladders, falls from standing or from down the stairs. Homicide, that's death at the hand of another. And then suicide is from a self-destructive act. And for that, I really need to see a preponderance of the evidence to show a suicide note, previous episodes of suicide attempts, drug levels that are really, really high, like way above what you'd expect for therapy. That's what I want to see for a suicide. And then we can also, as medical examiners, make a death certificate pending while we're waiting for our lab results to come back. You can't do that on a hospital autopsy. And also cannot be determined when we've done everything and we've exhausted all measures and we don't know. So typical good natural causes of death, all of these are etiologically specific. They're not due to anything else. Things like atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And you see I have the heart attack there. I have the myocardial infarct, but it's due to something, due to atherosclerotic coronary artery disease. Hypertensive stroke. Okay, that's a good cause of death. That'll kill you. Ruptured cerebral aneurysm. That'll kill you. Chronic alcoholism, even chronic disease states can kill you. These are all acceptable on a death certificate, okay? And you can also use the term complications of, infectious complications of chronic substance abuse, complications of diabetes mellitus. You don't have to be exact. But what's not good at all are things that I see a lot on death certificates, is stuff like this. There's two I absolutely hate. This is the guessing portion. Which are the two that I can't stand to see on a death certificate? Does anyone want to volunteer? Wait, what did you say? Not just respiratory. Cardiorespiratory arrest is the first one I can't stand. First of all, cardiorespiratory arrest, all that means is that your heart stopped beating and your lungs stopped breathing. That is the definition of death. Okay, everybody has that when they're dead. That shouldn't be on the death certificate at all. And then the other one that drives me crazy is multi-organ system failure, because that just means that your organs shut down slowly instead of dying, stopping all at once. And they're not specific. They don't tell you what they're due to. And all of the other ones on that list, like cardiac arrhythmia or respiratory failure, they have to be due to something. Did your heart have an abnormal rhythm because of valve disease or because of high blood pressure? Did your lungs stop breathing, respiratory failure, because of your asthma or because of your smoking and emphysema, COPD? Did your liver fail? What do you mean end-stage liver disease? Due to what? Is it due to all the Tylenol you took last week? Or is it due to your chronic alcoholism? Or how about the hepatitis C that you got many years ago? Those are all different disease processes. So you need to have an underlying cause. And the same thing goes for things like pneumonia or sepsis or even stroke. Sometimes people call strokes cerebrovascular accidents. That drives me crazy because, first of all, it's not an accident. Okay, accident is a manner of death. If it's due to high blood pressure, then it's actually natural. It's not an accident. And if it's due to cocaine, then it is an accident. But then I, the medical examiner, need to be notified about it. So a lot of these disease states, when I say due to something, the thing that they're often due to is somebody's underlying debilitated state. So, for example, even if you take something like pneumonia or sepsis, pneumonia and sepsis are much more common in people who are debilitated for some reason. So what is an example of a debility? Either they have dementia from something like Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease or multi-infarct dementia, or they've had a stroke in the past. Okay, if it's an ischemic stroke from lack of blood flow, that could be from blocked cerebral vessels, from blocked blood vessels. But if it's a bleeding stroke, a hemorrhagic stroke, that could be due to drugs. And if it's due to drugs, I need to know about it. Okay, it needs to be reported to the coroner or the medical examiner. And then the most important reason why these cases need to be reported to the medical examiner's office or coroner's office is because of trauma. Because trauma makes people debilitated. So if I have a death certificate that just says pneumonia and the person's 20 years old, that death certificate is not acceptable in any state at all. There needs to be an underlying reason why a 20-year-old person is dying of pneumonia. Okay? And in many cases, it's because they have some sort of underlying trauma, even if that trauma was remote. Okay? And that needs to be reported to the medical examiner's office, investigated, and that death certificate needs to be corrected. And then also chronic disease renders people susceptible to things like pneumonia and sepsis. So if, for instance, the 20-year-old is a chronic alcoholic who's been drinking since he was 15, then that should be on the death certificate as the reason for the pneumonia. So sepsis, for instance, what is sepsis? It's overwhelming infection. Typically, doctors diagnose it when you have a low blood pressure or your white cells are elevated when they test it in the lab, or you can actually sometimes pick up the organisms in the blood. But again, it's more common in debilitated patients. So if somebody's dying of sepsis, you can't just say on the death certificate, cause of death, sepsis due to E. coli. There, I'm done. I mentioned the organism. That's not enough. We need to know the source of the infection. Is it respiratory, like pneumonia? Then what is it due to? What's their underlying debilitated state? Is it a urinary tract infection? Well, then what's that due to? Is that due to, let's say, the fact that they've got an enlarged prostate from benign prostatic hyperplasia or from prostate cancer? And is it due to an intestinal infection? Well, if it's a gastroenteritis that you got from food, I need to know about that. That needs to be reported to the medical examiner's office. And if it's from a wound, from trauma, I definitely need to know about that. So now comes the graphic photos. So I'm warning you, this is the prompting slide. So I'm going to go through an autopsy so people who have never had a chance to see an autopsy get at least an understanding of what we do. The first thing I do when I have a dead body is I review the paperwork that comes with it. So usually I'll get medical records, or even if the person's never seen a doctor, I'll get some paperwork from the investigators saying they were found dead in their house, their brother found them, something about the circumstances surrounding the death, when they were last seen alive, when they were found dead, what the scene looked like, how many newspapers were piled up in the front door, something to give me a sense about when they died and why they may have died, including medications that they found in the cabinets, things like that. So first I will go to the body and look at the outside of the body and do an external examination. And then I will make a Y incision. And what I will do is I'll reflect back the skin. And right now you're seeing over here, this is the head up here. And this is the chest wall. And then over here is the liver and the intestines. And then the chest wall, the breastplate gets removed. And we actually do that with pruning shears. So if you go to like Osh, you can get them, the pruning shears for your tree. And they work very well. And then we can cut the ribs and reflect that up. And then we take out the organs and one by one we weigh them. And each organ gets weighed, measured, and inspected, and then sliced into pieces to look to see if there's any disease or injury to each organ. And all of this is documented. We document it in diagrams, we document it in photographs, and ultimately we document it in an autopsy report. And then all the organs are actually put back in a plastic bag that's put back in the body cavity. They're not put back in order or anything. They're just kind of all the slices are kind of shoved in the bag. And then the bag is closed up, and then the body's sewn right back up so that they can be brought to a funeral home and still have a funeral. And then when it comes to the scalp, the head, the scalp is actually, we make an incision, a cut, like kind of like a headband over the top of the scalp, and then the skin gets reflected forward. It gets scalped forward, pulled forward, and then pulled backward, which is what you see in this photo. And then that can be pulled back up and sewed up as well. So after I do all this, how do I figure out why the person died? And majority of cases are actually kind of easy. I mean, I would say that in close to 90% of the cases, I'll finish the autopsy and either know the cause of death or at least have an idea about what direction to go in. For example, I need some testing for toxicology. Most cases are easy, things like multiple gunshot wounds. Well, that's a homicide. But the ones that are hard tend to be hard for two different reasons. One, you have a compelling story, but no sufficient trauma on the body to account for death. So you've got this interesting story, but the trauma is not there. Or you have lots of trauma, but the story doesn't match. That's when you've got a problem. And when you have a disconnect between the story that you're getting and what you're finding on the body, that's when you have to start investigating more and asking more questions. So a good medical examiner will review all the data that's available before coming to a final determination. And that's sometimes tough, especially when you're handling a lot of cases. I mean, I'll be juggling at, depending on the office, I'll be juggling anywhere from 20 to sometimes 70 open cases at once, depending on the time of year and which office I'm working in. And the good medical examiner also tries to meet with the different groups associated with the case in the difficult cases to get more information when a story doesn't make sense. And the different groups I'm talking about are the police officers who went to the scene or the emergency medical technicians who first tried to resuscitate the person, or sometimes talk to the family. When did you last see them? What medications were they on? When was the last time they saw the doctor? And then get the medical records. And you try to keep an open mind and remain objective before deciding on the cause of death. So we actually sort through the findings, and this is a paradigm. This is a way I think. You're not going to see this classification anywhere in a death certificate or an autopsy report, but it's a way of thinking about death and thinking about disease. And I actually go through these classes in the book in Working Stiff and give examples for each one. So I'm going to do that here a little bit so you understand how pathologists think, how forensic pathologists think. A class one lesion, a class one autopsy, is one with an overwhelming pathologic finding. So gunshot wound to head, that's going to be the cause of death. If I have a gunshot wound to the head, I don't care if he's got kidney stones, I don't care if he's got heart disease, the cause of death is going to be a gunshot wound to the head. That's a no-brainer. Okay? Class 2 lesions, pun not intended actually. Class 2 lesions or class 2 diseases are when you have a disease with lethal potential. So a guy's found dead at home, there's no signs of foul play. I do an autopsy and I find severe heart disease. I've ruled out everything else. The severe heart disease is enough to kill him. It's not an overwhelming pathologic finding. Remember, if he had that gunshot wound to the head, I'd be ignoring the heart disease. I mean, I'd still write it on my autopsy report, but it's not going on the death certificate. Okay? It's not the cause of death. But if I've got that bad heart disease, that's enough for class two, for a cause of death, because it's got lethal potential. The example I like to give for class three, marginal pathology, is one with a compelling history, is a guy walks into the lecture hall, clutches at his chest and goes, I'm having chest pain, I can't breathe, and collapses. And then when we do the autopsy, we find 30% narrowing of his coronary arteries. Not much else. You know, most of us are walking around with about 30% narrowing. It's really marginal pathology. It's not enough to really kill you in most cases, but I've got the story. He came in, he clutched his chest, he collapsed. I ruled out everything else. Class three, I'm good to go. Class four is interesting because lethal pathology is not structurally demonstrable. And this is the difference between anatomy, which is the structure of the body, and physiology, which is how the body works. Okay? There are a lot of things that we cannot see at an autopsy. I can't see a seizure at autopsy. A seizure is an abnormal functioning of the brain where it's a neurologic storm, an electrical storm in the brain, and it only happens when the person is alive, and you can witness it and see it, but once they're dead, it's gone. The same thing for a cardiac arrhythmia, an abnormal electrical rhythm in the heart. If I happen to catch it on a Holter monitor or an EKG in the hospital, I'm good to go. But if the person's found dead at home, he might have a perfectly normal heart. And there may be some sort of metabolic or molecular abnormality that hasn't been identified yet that would cause, for instance, long QT syndrome, okay, where they don't have normal electrical activity in their heart. But I can't see that at autopsy. I would have to get his medical records and look at his EKGs in the past to see if it's there. And sometimes I have those and sometimes I don't. So that's class four. Things that are functional but not structural. And then class five is undetermined, where you do a full autopsy, a full investigation, you don't have much of a story or you just found some dead bones and you don't know what it is. And that's what undetermined is for. And they tend to be less than 5% of a forensic pathologist's practice. In mine, it's closer to 1%. It really depends on the jurisdiction where you're working in. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the different types of trauma so that you learn the terminology. Just this is exactly what I teach pathology residents. This is what I teach attorneys that I work with. Blunt trauma has to do with injury to the body from broad surfaces. So abrasions are things like scrapes or scratches. Contusions are bruises. So the surface of the skin is intact, but the blood vessels underneath are broken. And those are the typical bumps and bruises that we get. And then a laceration is when the skin actually tears from a blunt impact against a broad surface. And there are certain characteristics of it, such as tissue bridging, undermining, and irregular edges. And I look at the edges of the wound to see if they're irregular or if they have flaps, and that's what undermining is. So here's an example of a contusion. I love this one because it's got such a great story. Does anyone remember the story behind this one? Pretzels, what happened on the pretzel? He what? He choked on a pretzel. Very good. So what you have here is you have about a 1-inch, I don't have a ruler, but I'm estimating 1-inch red, so I'm doing size, color, and location, contusion with possibly a small abrasion at the center. And what's important is that it's over a bony prominence, okay? It's over a part of your body that juts out. So the story was that the president choked on a pretzel, passed out, and banged his head on the counter, okay? I think it was either a counter or a coffee table. And then the question is, does the story fit the observed injury? So in this case, because we have a single plane of injury over a bony prominence, it is consistent with what we call a fall pattern. And this is what we call planar injury against a plane. So if a person falls down and hits their face against the surface, we have a lot of bumps and indentations in our face where our eye is and where our nose goes. So you can actually have, as I demonstrate by putting my hand against my face, you can have an injury on your nose, on your forehead, and on your cheek, and they're all from a single impact against a flat surface. And the same thing for your chin, as I put a much broader impact, a flat surface. Okay? So you can have multiple bruises and scrapes on your face, but as long as they're all in the same plane of injury, they're all consistent with one impact. But if you start to have a lot of them on the back of your head, since we're egg-shaped on the back, each one is going to be a separate plane. And this becomes important when you're trying to distinguish between a fall scenario and an assault scenario. So this is, again, some of the graphic photos. Here's a typical fall pattern, where you have an abrasion on the cheek and a laceration, a cut in the skin, over the bony prominence. So again, this is typical for a fall pattern. This is not a fall pattern. This guy was beaten with a rod, and you can see 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? So each one is a separate plane of injury. And this is important for testimony because, first of all, he's dead, so he can't speak to what happened to him. And in some cases, even when people survive an assault like this, they may have no recollection of what happened. So that's where a forensic pathologist who can review the photographs and the medical records can count the number of planes of injury and testify to how many impacts occurred and whether it's a fall or not. These are typical lacerations. You can see the irregular edges and the undermining, the flap of skin. And I will actually shave them so you can see them better. And these photographs like these can be used in court as evidence. And this is a slide that shows you the difference between a laceration, which has undermining, tissue bridging, which is when the little pieces of tissue kind of stick together, and abraded edges from blunt trauma, as opposed to the nice, clean slice that you get from a knife from sharp trauma. So the terminology for sharp trauma is different. And again, this is material that a lot of physicians don't know because I will get charts from the emergency room that refer to everything as a laceration. A laceration is due to blunt trauma. If it's a gunshot wound, it's not a laceration. If it's a stab wound or an incised wound, it's not a laceration. So an incised wound is when a cut is made on the surface of the skin and it tends to be wider than deep. They tend to be very bloody, but they're often not as lethal because they're superficial. Stab wounds, where a knife is stabbed into someone, tends to be deeper than wide. They tend to be lethal because they're hitting major organs like your heart and your lungs and your liver. But at least on the outside, they're not as bloody because all the bleeding is internal. And then chop injuries occur with unwieldy weapons like hatchets or axes. They look sharp on the outside because they're sharp instruments. But on the inside, you see broken bones and they look blunt on the inside. So they tend to be homicide. So here's an example of a case that actually went to court that I testified on. And these are incised wounds. These are cuts on the neck. And you can see the sharp edges. And most importantly, I want to call your attention to this area over here near the chin, because that's where, I'm going to show you in a second, there's a patterned injury. So these are typical incised wounds, wider than they are deep. And this is a typical stab wound, and you can actually make out the thickness of the blade over here. And it's blunt edge over here and sharp edge over here, so you know it's a single-edged knife, okay? And that thickness of the blade is the most reliable thing to match to the weapon, because most people, you know, when they stab someone, they can stab deeper than the length of the knife because you have skin and it's elastic. You can press it in. And or they might not stab as deep. They might only stab halfway. So the length of the track might not be a reliable indicator of the size of the knife. And also the width of it might not be reliable because you can always move it. Okay, in the body, once you stab in, you can move it. But that thickness, most people don't jiggle it side to side. Okay, the problem is that if you start to examine knives, a lot of them have the same thickness. They're all about 1/16 of an inch. So I don't find it particularly reliable in all cases in matching to knives. It depends on the case. And in this case, you have incised wounds, you have cuts to a person's hand, and these are characteristics of what we term defensive injuries. So in the courts, it depends on which courts you are in. In New York, for instance, I wasn't allowed to use the term defensive injury. But what I could say is it's typical of someone grabbing at a knife or holding their arm up like this, and I demonstrate. So it's essentially the same thing. So you can have defensive injuries typically on the palm of the hand, on the forearm, or on the upper arm and the back. And remember that injury that I showed you on the chin of that lady? This is the injury. Does anybody recognize a pattern here? Does anyone want to try? It looks, yeah, I see you in the back. You're going like a scratch, right? But do you see a repeating pattern here? One, two, three, a little bigger. One, two, three. This is from a serrated knife. This was the knife that was found at the scene. And look at that pattern of injury. The serrations match. So if you have a serrated knife and it gets dragged across the skin, you can sometimes see that pattern and you can actually use it to match to a particular weapon as we did in this case. So now we're going to transition to guns. The most common ones I see are handguns because they're concealable. They're often used or purchased for self-protection. And the two most common kinds are revolvers and pistols. Now, a revolver, I don't know what your gun literacy is, but they have a single barrel and a rotating cylinder. And one pull of the trigger fires the chamber that's aligned with the barrel and then rotates the next chamber into alignment. But the casings stay in the weapon. Okay? So if you have someone who's shot and there's no casings at the scene, it's probably a revolver. Okay? Either that or they picked up their casings after they shot them. The pistols are self-loading semi-automatic firearms. One pull of the trigger fires one cartridge. They have a single chamber, and then they have a magazine that's usually in the grip, and then it ejects the casing every time it's shot. So in the cases where someone's shot with a pistol, there's usually casings at the scene. Okay? And either the casings can be matched to casings fired from, so if you can get casings at the scene, that's evidence, and then you recover the gun from a potential suspect, you can then fire that gun and see if the casings match, or if you can recover the bullet from the person who's died, or the bullet from the scene, you can match the bullets as well. So generally, this is not true in all cases, but generally rifles have a rifled barrel. That means they impart a spin to the bullet, and they fire at a very high velocity. And shotguns, generally, there are some shotguns that are rifled, but most of them are smooth barrels, and they fire shot, which are these pellets or a slug. So with regards to gunshot wounds, why do I need to know about this? I need to know about this because this is what kills people, and what I'm asked to testify to in criminal cases and sometimes in civil cases are things such as range of fire and direction of fire. So range of fire means how far away was the gun from the target, and direction of fire, what was the relative positions of the two people, and what was the direction that the bullet traveled in the body. And those will be either matched or contradict what the witnesses say. So you need to know that four things come out of a gun besides the bullet. There's gas. There's the complete combustion of gunpowder, which causes fouling. And that's like soot. It looks like the soot from your chimney. There's incomplete combustion of gunpowder, which causes little scrapes on the skin, and that's called stippling. And then there's also a flame. So here's an example of it. I've got a stop action here photo that you could see the flame. And the flame can cause searing of the skin. So if the gun is right up against the target, it'll actually get burned. And when you're close, the soot or smoke will deposit on the skin. And you can actually wipe it off, and you could see it on your glove. It's sooty. It's black. And then when you're at this intermediate range over here, these little teeny little particles of unburnt gunpowder can actually scrape the skin or scratch the skin, and they cause these little red marks, and that's called stippling. And then when you're furthest away, none of that gets to the target except for the bullet. So only the bullet will hit, and that will be a distant range gunshot wound. So here's a demonstration. When the gun is close, the soot deposits on the skin. And in intermediate range, the soot will not deposit, but you'll get the stippling, which is from the unburnt particles of gunpowder. And so here's demonstrations of different types of gunshot wounds and how we distinguish between them. So when a gun is hard, pressed hard against the skin, you could see the soot actually in the wound. The gases will split the skin, so you get this, what we call a blowback laceration. And then now if you have a very loose contact, instead of a hard contact, you get that searing or that burn mark around the gunshot wound. And then when you're close, you can have both soot and stippling. At the intermediate range, you won't see any soot, but you'll see the stippling. Those are the little black dots here. Sometimes they're a little reddish too. And then when you're far away, you'll get neither. And it's just the hole in the middle. So that's a distant range wound. So by looking at the wounds, as a pathologist, I can tell you how far away that gun was. And then the exit wounds tend to be lacerated. But you could see the difference between the hard contact laceration and the exit wound laceration, because the hard contact, first of all, has the soot, and second of all, has a big hole in the middle. Okay? This one, you can push those lacerations together. You could push those edges together. And it's not a true laceration, really. Remember, we talked about lacerations. They're supposed to have abraded edges and tissue bridging and undermining, and we don't have that here. So that's an exit gunshot wound. So for direction of fire, I have to figure out where's the entrance and where's the exit. And I have to look at the relationship of the entrance to the exit, okay? And typical entrances have a round punched out hole and a rim of abrasion. And typical exits are lacerated like this, okay? But either of these can be atypical, and it can be very confusing sometimes. So, for instance, if I shoot somebody and it ricochets off the chair, that's going to distort the bullet. So that when the bullet enters, it's not going to be a nice round bullet. It's going to be distorted, and that can cause an atypical entrance. Also, if it comes in right at the edge of like your eye and your nose where you have this uneven surface, you can end up with something that looks like an exit, but it's really an entrance and there's a bullet in your brain. Okay, so you figure it out from other things. And then for the exits, if someone shoots me as I lean up against the wall is holding my skin up, like shoring a wall. That's called a shored exit because it's holding up, the wall is holding up my back, so the skin can't come out. And it won't be lacerated. The exit will look exactly like an entrance. It could be a round punched out hole, just like this. So when you have a case where you have a bunch of gunshot wounds, what you usually do is you figure out which ones are the entrances and which ones are the exits, meaning they look like entrances or they look like exits. And then when you do the autopsy, you follow the blood, the track of blood between one and the other. And if I have an entrance going to an exit, I'm good to go. If I have an entrance going to an entrance or an exit going to an exit, then I look at those two wounds and I figure out which one looks more entrancy and which one looks more exity of those two. And then I also look at the other gunshot wounds and I look at the scene and the circumstances. If I can't tell, I say I can't tell. But if I know that the person is found in the chair, shot, and their back is to the chair and the bullet's in the chair, then I know it's a short exit wound and the entrance is in the front. So that's where the scene can also help me interpret it. So when the bullets get recovered either from the body or from the scene, they get brought to a ballistics lab where they do comparison microscopy. And they actually take the casing over here and they look at where the hammer of the weapon hit it and they do a comparison between the two. Or they can look at the ridges, the rifling marks, that are on the crime object compared to the reference object, and if it lines up perfectly, it's a match. Okay? So that all they really do is they say it's consistent with being fired from that gun, it's not consistent with being fired from a gun, it's not a match. So it's positive, negative, or I can't tell. And I can't tell usually happens when the bullet gets distorted. For instance, it hits bone, or if it gets ricocheted off the pavement where it gets damaged. So this is actually photographs of the ballistics lab from New York City, which I actually mentioned in the book. I took these photos when I was doing my fellowship. And this is their ammo room, where every time they discover new ammunition on the market, they purchase it. They buy a lot of it. And they put it in this room just in case they come across it at a crime scene. Or if they find ammunition at a crime scene, they'll buy for comparison. So that's how they keep it. And they have stuff that that's ammunition that's no longer being used. I mean, it's been there for years. And then they test fire the weapon into this water chamber because the water won't distort the bullet, and then they can use it for the comparison microscopy. And this is a test that was used in one of my cases where they actually test the trigger pull of the weapon so that if somebody is saying, well, the gun just went off, or I dropped the gun and it went off, or I didn't realize it was just so light, so they can actually measure the typical handgun and what the trigger pull will be. And they repeat it. They could do it with this scale, with a weight. They also have digital scales that can do it. And then this is another test that can be done in the ballistics lab, is a range of fire testing. So when I look at the body and I say that there's soot and some stippling, then they can take that gun and fire it at contact, 2 inches, 4 inches, 8 inches, at several inches intervals, and get the pattern for that specific gun with that specific ammo, so that then my testimony can be more accurate with regards to the distance, to the range of fire. And sometimes it helps me figure out whether something could have been a suicide. So when you try to figure out whether something is, let's say, a suicide or a homicide or an accident, you need to understand as a physician what is an instantaneously lethal target, what is going to result in instantaneous incapacitation. And those are injuries to basically the central portions of the brain. Are going to generally render somebody instantaneously incapacitated. They're not going to be able to get up and walk and fight or run away, okay? And rapidly lethal targets can take anywhere from 10 to 15 seconds of voluntary action afterwards. I had a case where a guy was shot through the heart. You guys know the Safeway on Webster Street, the one that's near Japantown. He was shot in that parking lot. He was shot through the heart. He managed to run across some of the parking lot and then across all 6 lanes of Geary Boulevard before collapsing on the other side. And this is a through-and-through gunshot wound to the heart. So you can still actually run quite a long distance away from an assailant or continue to fight an assailant with 10 to 15 seconds of voluntary action, even if you're shot through the heart. It's not going to drop you immediately. It's got to be the brain stem or the base of your brain or the cerebral hemispheres, including the gray matter, to render you incapacitated. And then targets of secondary importance are all others, your arm, your leg, that you can go on for days. You might even survive that. So when figuring out a gunshot sequence, we rely on witnesses, but sometimes we don't have them. So sometimes we can do a reconstruction based on a biological shot sequence. So, for instance, if I'm confronted with a suicide that has more than one gunshot wound, they're rare, but they happen. Obviously, the instantaneously lethal target cannot be the first. So if you have a gunshot wound to the chest and a gunshot wound to the head and there's a note and the gun is there and the room is locked, the chest one was first, the head was second, okay? Assuming that the head went through the brain and didn't just lodge under the scalp. And in a homicide, you can have many lethal shots, but sometimes things like hemorrhage and range and other injuries or even witnesses can help you figure out a sequence or the scene findings. For instance, you can have relationships among fracture lines, and you can have that both in glass and in bone. In this case, for instance, you could see this gunshot was first, and it made this fracture line, and this one was second because this fracture line was stopped by the first. So you can figure out number one and number two. So here's an example of a case of that was published in the medical literature that showed the fracture line from the hammer blow was over here, and then the stick was second, and it was stopped by the fracture line caused by the first. And you can see that right here. There's the first fracture line coming from this impact, and then the second one got stopped right there. So here's an example of a case of mine. This actually went to court, and I testified on it, where it's a homicide, but biological shot sequence was a factor in trying to figure out what happened. This guy apparently owed another guy some money, and he was working in his workshop, and the bench is actually over here to the left. You can see a little bit of the plastic bag that was on his workbench. And he had 4 gunshot wounds, but they were of different range, and they were going through different parts of his anatomy. The first one is the only one that went back to front. And all it did was go through his palate and eject a tooth. It wouldn't have killed him. The second one hit his lip and went out the back of his head. Again, didn't go through the brain, would have caused some bleeding, but would not have instantaneously incapacitated him. This is distant, but this one's now going front to back. So basically, the entrance to the place is over here, is off on this side right here. So whoever entered, if he's working on his project, which was on the bench, the most likely first shot was the one that got back to front, and then he turned around. All the subsequent shots were front to back, and the last one was instantaneously lethal and fatal. Okay, it was a contact gunshot wound to the head. And there was also an intermediate range wound in between. So the assailant is getting closer and closer. And this is what it looked like from the front. This is the contact gunshot wound to the head. This was the one that's instantaneously lethal. You could see some of the burn mark over here. You could see the blowback lacerations. Okay? This one has the stippling, so it's intermediate range. So the reason I'm showing you this case is that in the defense of this case, the defense attorney hadn't spoken to me, and he was trying to defend the case by making the argument that our victim was a judo expert and was threatening and attacking the defendant. And in fact, the final shot, the contact gunshot wound to the head, was allegedly occurred when the victim was coming at him like a bull, charging him. Now, does anybody here buy that? Do you think that it's likely that somebody, not only would he have to shoot him at a contact as he's coming at him, but he would have to do tight contact with the gun underneath him like this, because he's coming at him with his head down. So that's where the biological shot sequence doesn't fit the attorney's strategy or theory of the case. So I'm going to do this one. This is a participatory part. I know I have to stay at the microphone, but I need a short person. So who's 5'1", 5'2"? I need some hands. Okay, Dan, you're my participator. This is my son, Daniel. Give him a hand for being so brave. Okay, so that's my short person. I need someone who's at least 6 feet tall. Do I have a tall person? 6 feet? 5'11"? Okay, here we go. We got a tall person. Here, stand over there. I have to stay at the microphone, but you guys have to demonstrate. So the story is, so stand side by side so you can face the audience. There you go. The victim, he's our victim, our tall guy. What's your name?
Gaurav.
Gaurav. Gaurav is our victim. He's taller than the defendant by several inches, as you can see. And the witness said that the victim was kneeling. I'm going to have to ask you to kneel. And the defendant shot him execution style at the side of the head. So point at the side of his head and shoot him execution style. Okay? So that's what the witness saw. Okay? Now, the defendant, you, get back up. Yes, Danny, his story. So you can get back up. You said, no, that's not what happened. He wasn't kneeling and I didn't shoot him. He was coming at me, right? He's coming at me. And I shot him in self-defense. So put your hand up and shoot him in self-defense as he comes at you. At the side of the head. Go ahead, shoot him.
Me?
No, Danny, put your hand up and you come at him. Yeah, so there you go. But give me the side of your head. So you shot him at the side of the head. There you go, as he comes at him. Okay, good. So the body shows a close-range gunshot wound that enters at the temple and goes right to left, just like we're doing over here, and 30 degrees upward. Okay, who's lying? Or can I tell? Who's lying? Do you think that you're lying? Why?
Because bullets can't really move inside the head.
But it's going upward. So you're pointing upward, right? And it's coming at me, and I shot him in self-defense. So it's going 30 degrees upwards, right? So you're saying the witness is lying? Wrong. Can you kneel back down again? I want you to shoot him at the side of the head again, but this time I want, Gaurav, please, can you put your hand up to pretend to shoot him? No, Danny, put your hand up, Dan. And Gaurav, I'd like you to turn your head away from the gunshot wound like that. Guess what? You now have a 30-degree upward trajectory in his head. So the answer is I can't tell. Thank you very much. Let's give him a round of applause. Both stories fit because all I know from the trajectory is relative positions. And even just by tilting the head away, I can get that 30-degree upwards. And that's the honest assessment of what we have here. We can't always answer all the questions, but what we can do is we can look at the physical findings and look at the stories and say whether they're consistent or not consistent, or sometimes multiple versions are consistent. So that's the end of the lecture, and this is just to make you laugh. And then I'm here. I actually have a galley of the book if anyone wants to take a look at it. But I'm here to answer any questions until our time is up. So, and does anyone have any questions about the lecture or about anything having to do with forensics? Is fine. Yes?
What about the bullets? I can't remember the name of them, but the bullets that are especially just ghastly and are supposed to be outlawed and...
Are you talking about the ones that are called cop killer bullets or those kind of things? So there are a lot of bullets that are designed to penetrate armor, body armor. Some of them will have actually talons that can be very sharp, that can be expanding. The bottom line is that it really isn't so much the bullet that does the damage, it's the amount of gunpowder. Because the injury to the body is proportional to the kinetic energy of the bullet. So you can have two bullets of the same size, one fired from a handgun and one fired from a rifle. And the rifle round is going to cause a lot more damage because rifle rounds have a lot more gunpowder. It's the velocity that matters. And again, it also depends on so many factors, like what part of the body is hit, whether it's the hard part of the bone in your skull versus the soft tissues. That can affect the damage to the tissues. So it's not any specific bullet per se. It's more where it hits on the body, what the circumstances are. Ultimately, if you're going to start outlawing stuff, then you outlaw everything because they all can kill you. It's just a question of the how it's used and whether it's used appropriately or not.
I had a couple of questions. One is, why do you weigh the individual organs? And then secondly, how long after how long is the dead body good for an autopsy?
Okay, so the first question was, why do I weigh the individual organs? There are actually published in the medical literature and in textbooks normal weights of organs. So I know by weighing it whether it's normal or not just by the weight. And then if it's an abnormal weight, I have to ask myself, why is it abnormal? Is it abnormal because blood has backed up into it because the heart was failing from a natural process? Or is it because it's been damaged in some way by a toxin? For example, a fatty liver can get enlarged because of alcohol. So the weight is one of the measures, one of the ways I measure the possibility that there's a disease in an organ. And then the other question is, how long is a body good for autopsy? You can autopsy anything. You can autopsy bones. I mean, the body will slowly start to decompose over the course of many days. But typically, as soon as the body is discovered, it will be refrigerated. So we don't have to immediately autopsy anyone. We can hold them for a few days if next of kin needs to be found or if additional investigation is needed. It's not necessary to immediately do an autopsy as soon as the body comes into the medical examiner's office. There are, by the way, some countries, for example, in the Middle East, Israel is one of them, where because of religious prohibitions, the requirement is that you have to bury the body within 24 hours. They will do autopsies immediately. But that's not because of any scientific reason. It's because of the religious preferences.
So if the body's laying around for 5-plus days, it doesn't affect the results?
Not necessarily. It depends on what the cause of death is. So if it starts to decompose and the cause of death was something very subtle, for instance, a very, very small tumor in the adrenal that caused a metabolic abnormality, and the tumor's only yay big, once the adrenal starts to fall apart, and it'll start to fall apart in about 3 days, I may not catch that. But if the guy was stabbed or shot or overdosed on heroin, I'm going to still catch that, even in a decomposed body.
My brother was found, it was undetermined. So I was wondering, did they give up or was it a function of time not finding out what happened? Or
a lot of it, yeah. Well, that's a very good question. And one of the things that you can do is you can actually request the autopsy report. You have a right to it. Usually there's some nominal fee just for the photocopying or printing. And you can take a look at it and see, and sometimes call the pathologist who did that autopsy and ask them the questions, like what did you find out or what didn't you find out? Sometimes causes of death are undetermined because of advanced decomposition. Other times it's because of conflicting stories that don't quite make sense, that you have an overdose, but somebody's saying that one family member controlled the medication, so it's a homicide, and another family member is saying, no, they self-administered, so you don't know. Is it an accident or a homicide? So you defer and you say undetermined. Could it be either? It's an overdose. I know that's the cause of death, but I don't know which one it is. So undetermined is not a failure of medicine or a failure of the pathologist. Sometimes it's just not knowable. because of the limitations of our science. And sometimes it's not knowable based on the limitations of the information that we have, the medical records or the family members or the witnesses. And at a later time, we can always change it if somebody comes up and says, hey, I saw him and this is what happened.
How well do coroners perform compared to medical examiners?
A loaded question. The answer is that it depends. I've seen very well-funded, wonderfully functional coroner systems. Really, it depends on whether they're well-funded and they hire board-certified forensic pathologists. That's the bottom line. You can have a coroner system that's well-funded and well-run and has fantastic doctors, and it'll function better than a medical examiner's office that's been starved of resources for years and where everybody's leaving. So that's going to be the distinction, is how much are we going to invest in our death investigation system? And unfortunately, what I've seen is the life cycle of a lot of offices is that there'll be a scandal or an embarrassment, and that's when they'll start to throw money at the problem and hire more people, and it'll get better for a while. And then as soon as it's good, they start to neglect the office because there's no complaints and no problems. And so when there's cutbacks in city government or there's a new administration, oh, cut 10%, cut another position. The office slowly goes downhill. There's another scandal, and then the cycle starts again. In the back, in the red? Yeah.
For me?
Yeah.
My first is an observation. Physicians usually are dealing with patients who I assume that you're part of the medical world is the only one that has nothing but dead clients. Is that correct?
Well, that's actually not accurate. The question was, to repeat it, whether I only deal with dead people. The reality is I don't. First of all, the dead body is not my patient. The family members of that dead body are my patients. And it's something that people don't recognize about forensics because it's not really shown on television a lot or in the media. But we spend quite a bit of time talking to family members, explaining to them why their loved one dies, sometimes doing basic grief counseling or even giving genetic advice when we find genetic abnormalities on the body, referring them to genetic counselors if we find diseases that have a familial preponderance. So being able to help the family is my number one goal in any autopsy that I perform, is I want to be able to give them closure and give them answers because there's somebody out there who cares about this person. And that interpersonal skill is very important. The other thing about living people is, again, we do get called to testify and evaluate cases of trauma in living people where the living person doesn't remember what happened, and we have to testify in terms of injuries, or when the living person is lying and the physical findings are not consistent with what we're getting. So we will get called in those cases as well.
Now, my other question, if I may ask, has to do with that long, long list of reasons for or deaths or
causes of death?
Causes of death that are by law you investigate one way or another. The list was enormous.
Right.
Why isn't it the other way around? Instead of that long list, it's just everyone.
The reason is because of resources. So ultimately, the source of the reason for a medical examiner or coroner is to investigate cases that have a public interest. We're really not, the public doesn't have any interest in somebody dying of cancer or lung disease or heart disease from natural disease processes, and we shouldn't be, some people would say we shouldn't be forcing people to have autopsies or taking jurisdiction of cases when the cause of death is known and is natural. Clearly, those can be well documented in medical records and hospital charts and by physicians who are taking care of those patients. Our job is to step in when nobody else can speak for the cause of death or when the death has a forensic or legal significance. So if the law is going to supersede the authority of the family in terms of the taking property and possession of that body, we really need to have a public interest in that. And those would be criminal cases or cases of public health emergencies, for instance. In the back in the black T-shirt.
Is there money rewards in this profession sort of down the totem pole?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
Oh,
financial benefits. Actually, one thing that people don't understand about forensic pathology as a specialty, it's one of the few medical specialties where after you get your additional training, your earning potential actually goes down. So if I were to go into surgical pathology after finishing my training at UCLA in surgical pathology, I would have had double the starting salary that I had after doing my specialty training in New York City for an extra year. So it tends to be government work. The salaries are depressed, but you do have some of the government benefits that come with being a civil servant and civil service protections in some circumstances. The reason you get drawn into the field is not because of the money. It's because it's so fascinating. I mean, genuinely, I get asked a lot whether my job is like CSI, and I mean, I can go on and on about how those television shows are not accurate, but in one way that they are accurate is that it is so cool. I mean, I have to tell you, every day I go into work and it's, what is the Forrest Gump? It's like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get, and that's what it is. I don't know what I'm going to get. It might be an overdose. It might be a suicide. It might be an officer-involved shooting or a multiple gunshot wound. I don't know what I'm going to get. And I can handle it, and I can help people out, and I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction in getting feedback from the families and giving them feedback. You have no idea how many notes I get. There have been heartbreaking cases where I've autopsied babies, and the family will send me a card years later when they've had another child. They just want me to know that they've had. I mean, that just it's amazing that they would even think of me in those circumstances. In the back, in the blue.
Quick question. It kind of segues into what you just said about the exciting field. So I have a friend whose daughter is a senior in high school, and she's really interested in this topic and going on to college, and she wants to study forensics, but I'm not sure she wants to go the medical physician way in the years of schooling. What would you recommend?
There are so many other fields where you can still do or have contact with what I do. One is law, actually, to work in a public defender or a district attorney's office. Another one is social work with grief counselors, people who work with people who have dealt with traumas related to forensics, and they can testify, too, about the grief, the effects of grief or the psychological effects. I actually have some frequently asked questions, FAQs, at my website. My website is pathologyexpert.com, and I have a link to a blog there. So I have a blog post on Blogger where I put frequently asked questions because students will email me and ask me questions like, how do I get into forensics or what are the best programs? So I have questions and answers there as well, so you can let her know about that. But even like the death investigators at our office, they're police officers. They started at the sheriff's department, and they showed an interest in death investigation and an empathy with families so that they were drawn to that work, and they get trained on the job. So many of them just have associate's degrees and then went to law enforcement. So there are different ways of going into the field, not necessarily going to medical school. I think I already asked you a question. I'll give you a chance.
I was thinking that chronic alcoholism as a cause of death almost sounds kind of moralistic because they tell you not to smoke, so why isn't chronic smoking a cause of death, or obesity? But so what is it about alcoholism that makes it a cause of death?
I think because it's a slow poisoning, essentially, the alcohol is, but it also damages multiple organs simultaneously. I mean, generally, when smoking kills you, it's going to damage your lungs directly and either cause cancer or cause pulmonary emphysema. So typically in the smoking deaths, and we actually do, there are death certificate boxes for whether it's smoking-related illness, so that's also tracked as well. So typically in a smoking death, we'll write pulmonary emphysema if that's the mechanism, or we'll write lung cancer if that's the mechanism. But those are etiologically specific in the sense that even people who aren't smokers can get lung cancer. So that's where we distinguish between the two. In alcoholism, you get a poisoning both of the liver and of the heart and also of the pancreas, and direct irritation to the gastrointestinal system as well. So it's a way of lumping the death in when you've got multiple different factors, the liver damage plus the heart, or just the heart damage. And sometimes we won't just say chronic alcoholism. We'll actually delineate. We'll say dilated cardiomyopathy due to chronic alcoholism. So it's not just a congenital disease. It's due to the poisoning. Does that answer your question? Okay. In the back?
I wonder if you have seen the video of the autopsy of Kennedy. Professor
Of the president?
Yes.
No, I have not seen that video. Sorry, I can't really comment.
Very interesting. And I wondered if, since there are no medical examiners or no real pathologists present.
Well, no, the autopsy was performed by a pathologist, an anatomic pathologist. But my understanding is that there was a forensic pathologist in the room. He just wasn't performing the autopsy.
Okay, but there's a lot of doubt about that.
Well, I think that that's a very important point that you're making, is that any time there's a change in how things are done, whether it's because in that particular case the body was removed from Dallas and the autopsy was done elsewhere. So instead of being done at the jurisdiction where the death occurred, for whatever reasons, it was brought to a different location, there's always going to be questions brought up. And there have been several inquiries into the president's assassination, and forensic pathologists have reviewed the reports and have come up with conclusions with regards to how the injuries occurred. So there is sufficient information to say definitively how the trajectories occurred and how he was shot. There isn't any doubt to that. Most of that has just been perpetuated by the media. But I want to make the point that it is very important to have a forensic pathologist do a traumatic autopsy and not to change jurisdictions, because then questions start to arise, even if they're unfounded. I think you're the last question.
That 14-year-old girl who was at Children's Hospital in Oakland and had surgery for sleep apnea or something and never woke up, how do they manage to keep that out of the press? I mean, there was never any discussion about what actually occurred.
You know, I don't know much about that case, and given that I believe that the death was in Alameda County and I work in Alameda County, it's not appropriate for me to comment on that specific one. But in general, I want to warn all of you, is when you read something in the paper, don't believe everything you read in the paper. A lot of times, and this is just from my own experience, you know, working on cases and then seeing the case written up in the paper the next day and going, huh? Like, that's not what the police report said. That's not what the witness said. So I've been in the courtroom when people have spoken or when I've spoken and then seen it misquoted or misinterpreted. So take everything that you read in the paper with a grain of salt with regards to that.
Hasn't there been just incredible forwarding of hospitals joining together and telling each other about their mistakes and accountability, telling the truth when they make a mistake? Hasn't there been great strides made in that?
So the question had to do with strides occurring in what we call a medical risk management or root cause analysis. So in any hospital, and all hospitals have this, they're actually required for accreditation purposes to have mortality and morbidity rounds, M&Ms they call them, and they will have root cause analysis where lawyers who work with the hospital, risk managers, will assess any catastrophe, any death that may be due to an accident or injury in the hospital, and look and try to figure out what caused it and could it have been prevented. And what they've discovered, at least in the realm of medical malpractice, is that it's much easier to come clean and be transparent, because if you tell the family what happened and you're honest about it, they're actually less likely to sue. They just want to know what happened. And if they get angry and they feel that there's a cover-up, they're more likely to sue, even if there was no cover-up. So the communication is a big factor. And I'll take, I think, one last question. I saw your hand up earlier. Yeah.
I was wondering, sometimes on these TV shows, they exhume a body.
Right.
And I was wondering how common or uncommon is it? Who makes that decision? What does it look like practically?
Okay. So exhumations will occur if, for instance, a person was buried under the wrong name. There was an error made in identification, for instance. Or there wasn't anything suspicious at the time of the original autopsy, and now, or they weren't even autopsied at all. They were just buried, and then we find out that there are suspicious circumstances and we need to do additional testing. So the quality of the examination will depend on whether the body's been embalmed or not, because that's preservative, and for how long they've been buried, okay? Clearly, if they've been cremated, we can't really do much of anything. But if it's been embalmed and there hasn't been a long period of time, they're not just bones, you can still examine them. Exhumations are rare. I mean, in most cases, the processes that I gave you, the processes of reporting the deaths, having the police involved, having all those criteria, will catch most of the deaths at the time that they occur and be able to come up with a good identification and a good death certificate before that happens. But in the rare case of exhumation, I should tell you it's one of the worst smells I have ever experienced in my life. I've done autopsies on decomposed bodies, but the ones that come out of the grave smell the worst. And it's hard. I mean, it's from a physical standpoint, it's hard to do. But you still can learn something from the body. You can still look at the bones. You can still look at the structures that are still intact and try to answer the questions, whatever they are.
Have you ever done that?
Yeah, I have. I mention it in Working Stiff, actually. It's actually in there. And then, okay, my husband's got a question.
Doctor, so. When and where can we buy your
There's the shameless plug, right? We wrote it together, just so you know. I'm the idea person. I kept a journal while I was doing my training, and my husband's the English major, so he made it readable. The book is actually available for pre-order right now online, so if you go online and you want to pre-order it, you can, but it's not going to come out until August 12th. So August 12th is going to be the date. So if you pre-order it now, it'll be mailed to your house on August 12th, or you can download it if you're buying an electronic version on August 12th. But this is my first book. I mean, I've written chapters I've written articles in medical journals, but never one that's directed for the lay public. So I'm very happy. And if you want to see it, this is my last galley. Well, actually, we have a website for the book, and it's drworkingstiff.com. So, and then there's also a Facebook page for Dr. Working Stiff, where we put up updates about what's happening with the book, and if I'm going to have a book signing, that'll be on drworkingstiff.com and on the Facebook page. I don't do the DNA analysis, but I collect the DNA. So I need to know enough about DNA to collect proper specimens that then get sent to the lab for identification purposes. So, for example, all the 9/11 victims, the people from the September 11th disaster, they were many of them. In fact, most of them were identified by DNA. So even if they were identified in another modality by jewelry or clothing or X-rays, we also did DNA on them as well. Okay, so I'm still here if you want to ask me more questions. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.